Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Barack Obama was in Atlanta today, speaking before the National Convention of the Disabled American Veterans.
Shortly after taking office, I announced our new strategy for Iraq and for a transition to full Iraqi responsibility. And I made it clear that by August 31st, 2010, America's combat mission in Iraq would end. And that is exactly what we are doing, as promised and on schedule.
50,000 troops, however, will remain to train Iraqi security forces and conduct counterterrorism operations in Iraq. All the while, President Obama continues to build up the American military presence in a different U.S. war, the nine going on 10-year conflict in Afghanistan. And just yesterday, almost 700 soldiers of the Massachusetts 1st Battalion, 181st Infantry Regiment, shipped off for Afghanistan. It was the largest deployment of Massachusetts National Guard members since World War II. Senator Scott Brown was in Worcester yesterday to see them off.
I've been to Afghanistan, and what I noted there was the enthusiasm and excitement and the way that they're so focused on completing their mission.
But what exactly, I think the Senator Brown was supposed to be saying, completing their mission. And my question is, what exactly is that mission? Is it rooting out Islamic extremism? Is it stabilizing Afghanistan? Or is it something else entirely? Our guest today says that the very fact that these questions are hard to answer means that it will be impossible to ever say the mission is complete. In other words, America is on the path to permanent war. Listeners, has the U.S. embraced endless war? If so, why? Is having a military designed for global power projection the best kind of military to have? Or does it come at a cost, as our guest says? A cost to our military, a cost to our domestic needs, and a cost to our democracy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at wbur.org/Boston. Well, joining us now is Andrew Basevich. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Professor Basevich is also a retired Army colonel and the author of numerous books. His latest is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Professor Andrew Basevich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you very much.
So it's a delight to have you. And let me your book lays out very clearly your sense that we are on this path to permanent war, as the title suggests. But let me ask you, why is it that you say that, as we just heard President Obama saying the American combat presence in Iraq is going to be drawn down, but the one in Afghanistan is being built up. So does that not at least seem to be bringing a military presence to an end in one theater, if not another?
Well, I think we're kidding ourselves if we say that the Iraq war has ended. I mean, the Iraqi government just announced, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that during the month of July, over 500 Iraqis, civilians, police officers, and soldiers, were killed in what is, in fact, an ongoing insurgency. You know, the proponents of the Iraq surge insisted, and some continued to insist, that counterinsurgency was going to eliminate the threat to Iraqi stability and bring about some kind of a political reconciliation in Iraq. That hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And so, although it's true that President Obama intends to follow through on his vow to draw a line under our military operations in Iraq, that story is going to continue to play itself out for some time to come.
Mm. Professor Basevich, let me ask you, one of the reasons why you say in your book that the United States is on this path to permanent war is because of what you're calling the American credo. In other words, how we envision and use our military. It's a sacred military trinity, as you've called it. Can you describe what that trinity is?
Sure. I mean, so much of our conversation about national security these days focuses on Iraq and Afghanistan for a myriad of good reasons. That's where people are dying. That's where huge amounts of money are being spent. But the purpose of the book is to try to suggest that we have ended up with these ambiguous and protracted wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because U.S. national security policy over the past several decades has adhered to a certain pattern. And I label that pattern the Washington rules because people in Washington tend to be quite devoted to them. And really the pattern breaks into two pieces. One is a claim, and it's a claim that the United States and the United States alone is called upon to lead or save or liberate or transform the world. And I style that the American credo. And the second part of that pattern of behavior has to do with specific habits of national security policy. And that's the sacred trinity that you referred to. And I argue that the sacred trinity consists of an insistence that the United States, and again, the United States alone, needs to maintain a global military presence, should configure its forces for global power projection, and then should exercise the prerogative of combining that presence and those power projection capabilities to support a policy of global interventionism. That's the business that the Department of Defense has been in since the end of World War II. It's a business, it's an approach that has promised us peace and security at an affordable price, but I think it's becoming increasingly obvious, especially since 9/11, that it's actually delivering us into what is, in essence, a condition of permanent war. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's emptying the United States Treasury and bringing us closer as a nation to bankruptcy.
Well, Professor Bacevich, if I may ask, I mean, as you said, this credo emerged from World War II, from our experience of World War II. So I wonder, I mean, could another perspective be that it actually makes sense, given that that was the template by which we sort of redesigned the purpose of the American military? I was just going to say that while the conflict in World War II happened over there, so to speak, we learned and or believed that what happens over there could obviously have an effect here, and that perhaps in this interventionism that you speak of, then maybe putting out the little fires in the long run is better than waiting for one big global conflagration again.
Well, let me say two things. And the first is, yes, of course, there was a time, I think you can make an argument that the Washington rules made sense. In the particular conditions that existed in the immediate wake of World War II, let's say up to the Vietnam War, our position relative to others, the weakness of our allies, the threat posed by the Soviet Empire, all of these factors contributed to a shift in American strategy that in which the Washington rules made a certain amount of sense for a certain period of time. I'd argue that time is past. It's past in two senses. First is that we no longer sit atop the summit of global power. We have enormous domestic problems that demand attention. And the world is different also in the sense that, to a great degree, the allies who are most important to us can manage their own affairs and take care of their own security. Now, you suggested that perhaps one could make the argument that if you put out the little fires while they're little, then you'll avoid having to deal with the big conflagration. There's a logic to that. I would say that as applied in particular to the greater Middle East since roughly 1980, our experience hasn't sustained the case. Mm-hmm. That the effort to put out the little fires exacerbates anti-Americanism, fails to deliver stability, and in many senses seems to incite greater instability, leading then, of course, to calls for us to redouble our military effort.
So that's what puts us in the in part into that cycle of endless war. We actually have I'm sorry, Professor Bezevich, but we do have several callers who would love to pose a question or two to you. We are speaking with Professor Andrew Bezevich about the modern road to war and whether or not policymakers will ever allow the United States to disengage militarily from its obligations or its chosen obligations around the world. Paul's on the line from Nahant. Welcome to Radio Boston, Paul.
Hi, thanks. I think Professor Bezevich has said it all. We've either been at war or been preparing for war since the beginning of World War II at greater and greater cost. And what we've done is we've cut out the national resistance to fighting a war by eliminating the draft and having a volunteer army. But I wanted to ask Professor Bezevich to shift his gaze a little bit. He's been talking about the policy rationale, which he opposes, which he objects to, and he's also been talking about the kind of cultural milieu, American exceptionalism, mm-hmm. patriot, whatever. I'd like him to shift his gaze a little bit and tell us what the moving parts are. In other words, who profits from this?
Paul, thanks for your call. Professor Bezevich, your response.
Well, I mean, put simply, Washington profits. And I think that this is part of the great dilemma that we face. I don't believe that this pattern of national security policy, the credo and the trinity, I don't believe it serves the interests of the American people. But there are people in Washington who find great value in maintaining the status quo. That status quo delivers profits to the military-industrial complex. That status quo provides the rationale for maintaining levels of defense spending in which the United States spends on its own military a sum of money equal to that which is spent by every other country in the world. Maintaining the status quo sustains prerogatives that are exercised by institutions in the national security state. It provides opportunities for ambitious civilian officials or senior military officers to participate in what they fancy to be history-making events. So Washington is deeply invested in maintaining the national security status quo. And I think we the people, in a sense, have for too long been willing to buy the argument, which we hear repeated time and again, that if we don't lead the world and if we don't maintain this level of military dominance, that somehow the only alternative is isolationism and disaster. In fact, I think there are other choices that exist for us.
Professor Bezevich, one thing which I found quite remarkable in your book, and the point that it seems you're trying to put across here, is that this very much has to do with America's sense of itself, that we basically may have an exaggerated sense of ourselves, that the nation does, and that it shouldn't play the role of global leader when it comes to military or policing the world. So what is it that non-isolationist alternative then would look like?
Well, I think a couple of things. One would be, I think it's a question of what does it mean to lead and what is the most effective approach to leadership? President Bush in Iraq, President Obama in Afghanistan believe that leadership entails the use of military power in order to force fundamental change in societies on the far side of the world. I think that doesn't work. I think it costs too much. Mm-hmm. An alternative is to say that perhaps leadership could be best expressed by living up to the values that we profess, by demonstrating that liberal values do provide the basis for a society in which equality, opportunity, decency can flourish. There is a long-standing tradition in our history, now mostly forgotten, that insisted that America's proper role in the world was to serve as an exemplar. I would argue that we should revisit that proposition and consider that as a founding principle of foreign policy.
But there are some who would say that that, while noble and maybe should be our top line effort, just in this day and age isn't enough, that you need to have the iron fist within the velvet glove to prove that when push comes to shove, America can and will defend itself and its interests abroad.
Well, first of all, in arguing that we should transition from basically a role of global imperialism to one of serving as an exemplar, I don't for a second imply that this could happen or should happen overnight. There would be a long period of transition to a different approach. But I guess the other thing I would say is that, of course, what I'm advocating does not argue for disarmament and pacifism. We should have a strong and capable military, but we should become more prudent and realistic in our understanding of what that military should be designed to do. It's striking, the comment about Massachusetts National Guardsmen being sent off to Central Asia. The colony of Massachusetts, in many respects, was the birthplace of the American militia tradition. Mm-hmm. The concept of a citizen soldier, of a citizen whose responsibilities as a citizen included an obligation to defend the community. But it was to defend the community, not to try to transform the way Afghans live their lives. So, again, I think that there is actually quite a rich, if neglected, tradition that could wean us away from our excessive emphasis on military power and lead us toward a wiser path.
Professor Bacevich, there's so much to speak with you about that you raise in your book, but I've got, unfortunately, a limited amount of time, but I do want to ask you one final question. You raise the concern that unending war poisons the military itself. It affects the military itself in a way that's not good for American democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we saw an example of this in the recent McChrystal debacle, when that Rolling Stone reporter wrote the article in which he was quoting people around General McChrystal making derogatory comments about civilian authority. Those comments were wrong. That said, one has to have a certain amount of sympathy for the American soldiers who are being sent on repeated tours to Iraq and Afghanistan, where either you're in a combat zone or you just got back from a combat zone and you're getting ready to go again, while in the meantime, the vast majority of our fellow citizens carry on as if there is no war at all. That, I think, poisons civil-military relations. It's also morally wrong and should cause all of us to consider the second and third order consequences of accepting war as a normal condition.
Hmm. Well, that's Professor Andrew Bacevich. He is a retired Army colonel and professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. It's his latest book amongst many. Professor Bacevich, true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you very much.
When we come back, you know how most of us have an old yearbook photo we'd like to expunge from history? Well, architecture fans are begging Boston not to give in to the same urge when it comes to some of our less popular modernist buildings.
I'm very much reminded of the 1970s when we were losing Victorian buildings left and right before the country had developed an appreciation for Victorian buildings.
The fight to preserve some of architecture's ugly ducklings when Radio Boston returns. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back.